not a
once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. I feel funny saying this, as usually it's Old Baldy saying it. Old Baldy, Jeff, is out on vacation this week. This is Jake McClure with the Personal Wealth Coach, and there are some things that we should say here. First, the Personal Wealth Coach is an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. That's coincidentally also the name of this program. I am not going to be giving investment advice on the air, though. I'm going to be that would be inappropriate, to say the least. I will be giving a lot of good education, and that's what the purpose of this program is to educate in the world of economics and finances and whether or not you've been hacked by Equifax and many, many other things today. So, usually we start the program with what's happened during the week. Well, this week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 2.16%. That's a lot. That's more than a normal week. The S&P 500, which is a better representation of the overall marketplace, I believe, came in with a 1.58% increase this week, which is, again, that's a large jump. It's not something we see every week. That was in a week that we're still being ravaged by the effects of two hurricanes, a massive hack at Equifax from over the last several weeks, the Bitcoin dropping like a rock. There's a lot of things that have gone on, and the American economy is in great shape. So what else happened this week? Let's see. The 10-year Treasury note yield climbed from last week's 2% yield to about 2.2%. That doesn't sound 0.2% doesn't seem like a lot, but that's a 10% difference from what it was last week. Interest rates going up like that have some relatively good explanation. I'll be getting to that later in the hours of the program. Gold was down 0.44%, which says something on its own, I suppose. And more importantly, U.S. oil, that's West Texas Intermediate, closed at 49.83. That's $49.83 a barrel. That's an absurdly low price compared to not that long ago, just a few years back. We're talking about it being more than twice that. And again, this is with a hurricane going right through the Gulf, doing what the kind of damage to the refining system that is appropriate for that size of hurricane. And yet, gold gold is down. Oil's not up that much. We're in a new and different climate than we were just a few years ago. And people tend to think that any given climate in the market, in the economy, is going to be the same every time. And one of the danger signs we look for is it's different this time. When someone says it's different this time, you know, why didn't oil jump up? That's an easy thing to look and see. Yes, there are factors that are different, very easy to understand factors. There's a lot more oil available than there was after Katrina. When someone says it about the market as a whole, that it's different this time, then they're walking in a minefield, because what causes prices to be up or down hasn't changed. If a price, for instance, of oil, it's supply and demand. That's no different than it was before. There's a lot of people in the news that are shocked and keep bringing up, what's different about this time around? Well, the rules are all exactly the same. And this Harvey and Irma together didn't do the kind of damage to the system that we've seen in the past, because we've gotten better at preparing. And we've got a lot more supply. It takes a lot less time to get from the pump to the refinery than it used to. We used to have to bring so much of our oil from other locations. And those other locations required tankers. Big tankers coming across big water. And the big water, when it was not in good shape from hurricanes, it took a lot longer to get here. Well, we're using pipes in the United States now to get oil from the United States to the refineries in the United States. They had a really good practice with Katrina, and practice being a little bit tongue-in-cheek. They got good at dealing with the emergency. We had one back then. The time frame for getting refineries repaired was enough that it's still very, very recent memory in the oil industry what happened at Katrina. So they were much more prepared this time around. That's kind of a blanket statement about a lot of emergency preparedness that's going on. I have a subject that I'm probably going to spend a good amount of time on today. Before I do that, I'm going to give the phone number to call in here if you'd like to join on the air and add your voice to mine talking about something to do with the economy or finances, preferably not sports unless you just wish to expose my ignorance to the world. The phone number in here is 254-773-1400. And the subject that is kind of the big subject of the day, it's encryption. And the first thought out of your head may be, what does that have to do with the economy? What does that have to do with finances? Part of what I do here, part of what we do here, is educating the public on a whole series of areas. And we've been getting a lot of questions about Bitcoin and about the Equifax hack, and about computer security. What does that have to do with being in the world of economics? What does that have to do with finances? Well, it's kind of like saying, what does the lock on a vault have to do with keeping money secure? It's pretty obvious when put in that context. I'm not a locksmith. I don't do encryption for a living. However, being around security in the financial world, it's really, really hard to not have encryption be part of my day-to-day life. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the basics. People get scared of this stuff, and it's the very, very basics. Encryption is just analogies, just like words are. A tree, the word tree, is not a real tree. It's a representation, a verbal or written representation of the concept of tree. When codes were first really being developed to protect written documents from enemies being able to look at them, the first code was probably just writing, because most people weren't literate. Encryption, the word encrypt, just means to surround with walls. Think of a crypt. It means to protect it. And most writing, early writing, was surrounded by walls. It was considered holy material. It's taken us millennia to decipher the hieroglyphics on the Egyptian tombs because it was encrypted messages to their gods. They thought it was a method of holy communication. And put in that context, everything that we do is encryption. If you don't speak French and you speak in English, you have just encrypted your language for someone that doesn't speak English. So with that in mind, taking the next step up, encrypting English, encrypting German. In the mid-1600s, there's a guy named Leibowitz, who's one of my heroes, right up there with Isaac Newton, going way back. Together, between the two of them, they each invented calculus. Newton did it a little bit early and influenced a lot of the calculations that Leibniz did. So that's the kind of mind that we're talking about here. Leibniz is also the guy that developed binary code, which is in every digital device that we use. Everyone. It may not be forever, but right now, all digital technology is based on Leibniz trying to encode communication between minor countries in what is today Germany. You got to remember, Germany at the time was a whole passel, a massive number of nations. And they were constantly at war with each other. And they had big neighbors that were not necessarily friendly. So Leibniz was hired to develop a code to encrypt messages. And he used binary. And what's funny is the spies would take these binary messages across borders in ladies' cross-stitch fabrics. So it was binary code, very simple, just these sets of numbers represent this letter. It's very much like the Little Orphan Annie decoder ring. You just turn the dial, A equals Z this time around. Only in binary, A equals a series of zeros and ones. And that concept didn't take off right away. But Leibniz was also kind of the early developer of a much, much more advanced coding system that was used by the Germans in World War II, the Enigma machine. He developed the very earliest form of it. It had two wheels instead of three and then four and then five, which happened during World War II. They basically just used technology from the mid-1600s to foil the rest of the world's smartest people for a while, until Turing came along with a more advanced binary machine, the modern equivalent of what Leibniz had done in the 1600s. So computers as a whole, in order, the whole concept when someone is programming, they call it coding. They call it coding for a reason, because it's language that the machine can understand to do functions. And if you don't understand the code, it's encrypted. So the concept of encryption, we use it all the time. We don't use it well most of the time, but we use it all the time. And people tend to think that they don't understand it at all. It surrounds us. You absolutely understand it at a very basic level. You may not be able to do a 256-bit encryption algorithm in your head, but you can say the word algorithm, which is an encryption algorithm. The concept of algorithm, which is not concrete. You can't look around at the natural world and see an algorithm anywhere. So we have a concept, the word algorithm, for the concept, which is an algorithm. That's pretty encrypted. If you were saying that to a Stone Age or Iron Age individual, they wouldn't have a clue. They would think it was some kind of magic. And we tend to think that encryption is some kind of magic. The thought that Bitcoin, what does that have to do with encryption? Well, it's a cryptocurrency. And we'll get into some more of that information in a bit. Equifax, the fact that we have credit reports out there and the fact that banks collect data and bureaus for banks collect data on how much money we owe and whether or not we pay our debts. That seems to be a pretty reasonable thing if it's kind of like the Better Business Bureau for banks, where they say, hey, or Angie's List for banks. It's kind of a really early social media that only the banks were able to look at. Congress got involved and said, well, hey, wait, you're keeping records on people. I think the people whose records you're keeping might need to have the ability to look at that to see what you're gauging them on. And so Congress passed a law that said that we're allowed to look at our credit reports. It's pretty interesting because our credit has a very, very basic encryption system. And it's based on your social security number. You know, people tell you and have told you your whole life probably, don't tell people your social security number. That's a really bad password, by the way. It never changes. It's got a lot of digits in it, but it never changes. And if you've ever been in the military or applied to the military, then it's public record. The fact that we're using a social security number right now to guard all our assets is laughable. This takes us back to the Model T Ford. There were no keys for that vehicle. Anybody could walk up, get in that vehicle. Well, you had to be outside the vehicle to start it to begin with. Then get in the vehicle. It only had one door. It had another door painted on it. That's very, very basic security. You only had to understand how to start it to start it. And early on, that was enough because most people had no clue how to start that thing. As more of them existed, more and more people said, hey, it's easy to start these things. And then, lo and behold, we had the advent of auto theft. The market doesn't provide a solution until there's a demand. That's kind of a basic underlying factor of the entire economic spectrum. If they produce a solution that nobody wants, nobody's going to buy it. So it might get produced and just sit dustily in a corner somewhere. But the concept of putting keys into the Model T, into later versions of vehicles, keys for the ignition system, keys for the door, that didn't come from the auto manufacturers. It came from third parties who would come in and stick them on the vehicle and say, here, now you're saved. It started with people just putting chains on them like a bike chain. So this concept of security, like we have this vision of security as something that people just supply. We have to ask for it as a people. And the fact that Equifax, the credit, one of the three major credit reporting bureaus, was hacked and hacked at the level that it was, for those of you who haven't been paying attention, about 143 million people's data was lost. About 100,000 of those included credit card numbers. But the reality is we don't know how many other credit card numbers went out. And this is one of the problems. They weren't good at checking. They weren't, Equifax didn't have a system in place to check regularly, automatically, whether somebody was invading their server. So to go back to the Model T analogy, if somebody was coming and borrowing your car every evening when you weren't there, and you came back and you said, hey, you know, I keep noticing that somebody's moving the stuff around inside my car. Well, when did that start? Well, I think it started right back around, and we might be able to, if you kept a daily log, which is what computers do, a daily log of where things are kept, and you notice, hey, I didn't move that item on that day. So I think that's the day they got in. Until you install some other kind of security, whether that's a security guard or a camera, or it's really hard to install a camera if we're talking about the era of the Model T, the security guard who's watching, then we can detect the intrusion. But the security itself needs to be brought up. And this is one of those areas where we expect, I don't know who the we is, but there's like this understanding, the media's voice out there that says, we expect the government to protect us from this thing. Well, the government's not going to buy keys and locks for your house for you. The government's not going to buy keys and locks for your car for you. That's up to you. Burglary is a pretty good incentive to secure your property. But there's still places where you don't lock your doors. There's lots of little towns around Texas where it's normal not to lock your door. You still have a lock on your door. When was the last time you went to a house that didn't have a lock on it? Some of our older listeners, I'm sure, remember when the locks were all on the inside of the door. They were latch locks. They were bar locks. But you couldn't really lock it well when you were leaving. You might have a special chain lock for when you were out of the house for a long period of time. That's the state that we are in right now when it comes to our computer systems. Our systems for controlling our finances require personal responsibility. And that's something that's usually in the political spectrum when they say, I believe in personal responsibility. There are a lot of people that I know that are responsible people, but because they're not aware of the need, don't have antivirus on their computer systems. So on that note, and I'm covering a lot of little subjects in the realm of encryption. On that note, the United States government has just moved to restrict Kaspersky as an antivirus system. What does that have to do with Equifax hack? Bear with me. I don't think there's not a direct connection, but there's a lot of things in the same ballpark. Kaspersky Labs was developed by Mr. Kaspersky, who went to a KGB institute. Kaspersky Labs is in a former KGB building in Moscow. The majority of the programmers at Kaspersky's labs are reserve Russian soldiers, officers and soldiers that work in encryption for the Russian military. It's about time that the United States government said, okay, let's do something about that. Let's not allow them on government computers. And that's what the restriction is. That's what the new rule is, that the government computers aren't supposed to have Kaspersky on it. So this goes back to Leibniz. It goes back to, one of the earliest forms of cracking encryption was that the first basic form of encryption was actually writing something down. Well, this is after verbal languages, writing something down. Well, in Europe, for a very long period after the fall of the Roman Empire, the only literate people were priests or friars of the church, of the Catholic Church. And the church was a political as well as religious entity, a major political entity. They were the ones that determined who was king or who was in charge of what country. So a lot was owed to them. And if you were in a conflict with the church, say you're some head of state, you're in a conflict with the church, in order to send messages to your own subordinates or to your friends or to gather allies, you had to write it down. But the only people that knew how to read were the church. If the church was your enemy, you were basically sending all of your personal and encrypted information to the people that were most able to open it up and read it. That was an interesting time. And it was solved in England by Henry VIII. You know, there was a big thing about he split with the Catholic Church over not being allowed to divorce. The reality was that the split went much deeper. He didn't like the control that the Catholic Church had on him. So he had a bunch of other people that knew how to read. And he had his own priesthood set up. So in effect, that was a firewall, an information firewall that was being put in place between England and the Catholic Church. Kaspersky, as an antivirus or any antivirus, you have given permission to look in detail at all the files on your computer. So we better be able to trust the antivirus companies. Microsoft has included that now in their operating system. Some people say it's not as great an antivirus system as some of the others. I tend to think it's just as good. I think it's in some ways better in that it's in the operating system. Apple is way behind the power curve in providing some kind of antivirus system, because for so long they had such a small percentage of the market share that hackers didn't write viruses for Apple because there weren't enough of them out there to have any kind of impact. They didn't have the lulls, the laugh out louds, the giggle fits, and in some cases the monetary reward for hacking an Apple. That's not true anymore, but Apple is still in that same thought process of, hey, nobody hacks Apple. That's a decade-old misconception. It's no longer true. So underlying all of this, a piece of education is everybody needs to have antivirus on their system. Now, I just heard that a very smart person had three sets of antivirus software running at the same time, and that doesn't help at all. You need one. You need to be able to trust it. If you've got three running, they're going to be struggling with each other to scan the same files at the same time, and they will lock each other out. It'll seize up the whole system. So don't go that route. I said Bitcoin earlier. I realize that this sounds like there's a lot of subjects here. It's all the same subject. Antivirus to prevent viruses and other nasty things on your computer from reading what you're doing on a regular basis or reading your files on a regular basis. Getting good passwords when you log onto financial websites and checking your credit, because your credit is one of the least protected areas out there. People are, this is another very smart group of people came to me about this Equifax hack and said, I said, you need to go to the Equifax website, and I encourage all the listeners to do this. Put in your information. They offer a free service for a year for anti-theft and anti-personal information theft. I'd take them up on it. You don't even have to have been affected by this to get it. So go ahead and go to the Equifax website, log in there, put your information in, and I was saying this to someone at the office, very smart people, and they said, we're afraid to give that information to them. We're giving them the very information that they lost. Well, they already have the information. They didn't lose it and then they misplaced it and don't have it anymore. Somebody copied their paper. Somebody copied their machine information. They still have it. They need it to verify who you are in order for you to not have to use the publicly available now information to check your own credit. I'm going to make a prediction here that there is going to be a piece of technology. I don't know what it is yet, or I would be developing it. There's going to be a piece of technology that thoroughly protects our data. Encryption is just kind of a concept. It isn't the technology. There's a lot of different kinds of encryption. There's going to be some method where people will be able to verify who you are and keep that safe. Now, it may be as safe as the keys in your pocket. It may be that that's still something that someone can get, but it's easier to protect somehow, whatever this new technology is. So I highly encourage, in the middle of this, to go on, freeze your credit at the three major credit bureaus. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. In our last newsletter, we have lots of links and information on how to do it. The idea here is you freeze it. There's and this is funny that the term that is coming out of this, there's a temporary thaw. If you are about to apply for a car loan, they issue you a personal identification number so that you can verify who you are. This is a great huge leap up over verifying a social security number. Because the reality is that it's likely, very likely, that your social security number was already known by the bad guys before the Equifax hack. It's very likely, I would say almost impossibly not known. The reason is because the Social Security Administration may not link your name to the number, but they do the numbers in a logical order. If you're born in a certain area, you get the same sort of preset numbers at the beginning. If you have access to the logical progression of Social Securities, then the number's already out there. Linking it to a name isn't that hard after that. All you have to do is, over the last several years, try logging onto a credit service with that Social Security number. Now, the security's gotten a little bit better since then. The underlying point here is freeze your credit. It's kind of unreasonable not to. If you've got your credit information, this is basically all the information about you as far as how good you are with your debts. This is another kind of underlying point that I need to get out there. Investment accounts and bank accounts are not tracked by the credit bureaus. Just the debts, just what you owe people, and not all the debts. So if you owe someone for your light bill, which you do every month, that's not going to be part of your credit bureau report unless you're late on the payment. If you're really late on the payment, they report that to the credit bureau. They're not going to report your bank account. They're not going to report your investment accounts. So the assets that you have are protected. I'm in the middle of talking about the Equifax hack. They're probably the largest component here is how do people get caught for this? I mean, somebody was on the system from May to July, access to the Equifax computer system for months. For 3 months, they were on that system, coming in the evening and borrowing the car while you were out, basically. They had access to this information. It's now September. We find out, okay, they had access. It's September. It's months later. You need to freeze your credit because why wouldn't you? I mean, if your credit is out there and available for any credit card company to look at a much simpler version of your entire credit report, they can look, they can send you a free credit offer. Hey, join our credit card, have some toasters. If you freeze your credit, they're not allowed to look at that unless they are already doing business with you. You already have a card of theirs, and you say, I want a credit increase. Then they can pull the report. That's something that you have asked them to do. If you think about that just for a minute, putting a freeze on your credit is just a really, really rational thing, and what I expect to happen once Congress figures out what's going on here, and I don't mean the Elizabeth Warren bill. Once Congress figures this out, it should be a default freeze where, of course, nobody's allowed to look at your credit unless you give them permission to. Just think about that concept there for a minute. People are allowed to right now unless you actively go out and tell the reporting agencies no. They're allowed to pull information on you at a whim to get your address, your name, to send you a credit card offer, to say, hey, you need to get your credit refinanced under this whatever. It also allows people to apply for credit in your name without your knowledge. If you're doing it, you obviously know you're doing it. If you're applying for credit, hey, I want a credit card, then the step should include, okay, tell the credit bureau, this is really me. I really am doing this. If anybody that's ever applied for a credit card knows that there's a little piece of paper. Sometimes you can do it online. You scribble in some very basic information, send it off, and you get a credit card, or you get denied based on the credit report. if you've got it frozen, you fill out that stuff and they contact you and they say, what's the PIN? What's your issued number to say this is really you? Not the social security number, a personal identification number. Now, having said all of that, going to go back to Leibniz for a second because I'm going to hit on the Bitcoin concept. Binary digital communication was developed in the mid-1600s. It's not considered encryption anymore because it's so easy to understand. Too many people understand it. It's no longer encrypted. It's out in the open. It's become valueless as a code to keep people from reading your stuff unless you just write it on a t-shirt and the only people around that can read it are programmers. You can take a picture of it and a computer can decipher it for you. It's not good encryption anymore. Not enough people write in binary for it to be a common, you know, we don't write each other letters in binary. Unless you are a nerd. I have a great deal of respect for the nerds in the world. I am one, obviously, from what I'm talking about. So this whole concept, and I'm going to give the phone numbers, and then I'm going to get really into the Bitcoin. The phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. And I'd love to have some conversation. So with the Bitcoin, first level of encryption, let's go way, way, way back to Leibniz. First level of encryption was one-bit encryption. One bit, what is a bit? Besides a Monty Python saying, a bit. A bit is a zero or a one. That's all it is. It's a zero or a one. And that's the only choice. It's an on or an off switch on a circuit. If you think about the light bulb, there's a circuit. A simple light bulb goes from the switch to the light, back to the switch, and then out in and out comes from the power supply. When you turn that switch on, that's on. When you turn it off, it's off. That the zero is the completed circuit. The one is okay, it's not going anywhere. The ends are stopped. That's binary. You understand it. And I've got a caller on 773-1400. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, enjoy the show. Once you finish this latest topic, I know your commercials say, you know, you have a different perspective than the talking heads on TV, but on Fox Business News, they interviewed the guy that wears the cow suit. And he said that bonds are going up and stocks are going up, and that is not supposed to happen, and it's going to end real ugly. So I just, again, after you finish your Bitcoin thing, if you could kind of address that, what he meant. All right, I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. All right, let me hit Bitcoin real quick. So one-bit encryption is a zero or a one. Early encryption would say four-bit encryption. And that's a random set of zeros and ones that go out four digits. And it's pretty basic stuff, but computers had a lot of time doing it. It was actually faster to do with an abacus or on a piece of paper to decrypt four-bit encryption. We're now up to 256-bit encryption and 512-bit encryption, which is a lot of digits, but we're still only talking about zeros and ones for each of those. So it's not like the entire alphabet plus some numbers for each digit. It's not like an infinite number of symbols per digit. It's two symbols per digit, which is hard to decrypt. There's a lot of different combinations of zeros and ones that can be in 256 digits. It takes a computer a long time to find the right one. If we have a step up in technology, and when we have a step up in technology, whether that's quantum or light computing, and MIT's working on both of those, DARPA's working on both of those, Google's working on both of those, China's working on both of those, the concept is that you have an infinite number of symbols for each spot that has a zero or a one, which means 256 bit encryption will be very easily crackable by any of these new machines when they come out. And I would say 5 years. Now, why is that important? Because the whole reason why Bitcoin is supposed to have a value is that it is an encryption, it's a set of two encryption keys, a public and a private. There's a great algorithm out there that limits the number of Bitcoins to 22 million. That's a artificial thing, just like the algorithm is, an artificial thing that says, hey, you can't have more than this. Why is it limited? Well, that's just to make sure that they have some value, as if just having scarcity would have value. There has to be a demand beyond the limited supply for the value to go up. And the demand goes away when those keys no longer encrypt. If someone reports those keys out there, the Bitcoin becomes valueless. Once quantum computing or light computing, just think of a light and think the spectrum of colors all through, if you want to say Roy G. Biv, the rainbow, whatever, there's a lot more colors than that. Those colors would be each of those minute differences in colors, and there's no end to those, would be taking any of those could take the place of a zero or a one. It just is how sensitive are our light receptors. And we're getting pretty sensitive there. So Bitcoins long term have a real problem. And it was only 3 weeks ago that I said the big danger to Bitcoins is China. And Bitcoin just took a massive tumble, down about 23% in a very short period of time, because China is shutting down the Bitcoin exchanges and is said that they will continue to shut down Bitcoin exchanges. The exchanges themselves haven't even shut down yet. They'll be shutting on the 30th of September. And yet we've already seen that kind of drop as the Chinese are beginning to look for other ways of getting money out of the country. All right, now I'm going to go to the caller's question right after commercials. I will be back on the other end with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. The number to call in here is 773-1400. The area code is 254-773-1400. I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And I'm back. More of the Personal Wealth Coach. The numbers to call in here are 254-773-1400. Just before the break, I had a call about a guy in a cow suit being interviewed on TV. I just have to take a moment and think about that. I may be wearing a cow suit at the moment. You don't know. I could be. All right, so what he said was that bonds and stocks are both going up at the same time right now, and that that may lead to some great disaster, and it has in times led to disaster. Let's talk about why they might go up at the same time, and there's an assumption in here that bonds and stocks shouldn't act the same way all the time. They don't act the same way all the time. They do act the same way sometimes. Let's kind of break this down so that it's really easy to digest. A bond is a loan. You are a bond issuer for every dollar that you have on deposit at the bank. They owe you money. There's some type of interest involved. It may not be very much, but they have a contract with you to pay you interest on a loan that you gave them. On their books, it's a liability. So you're a bond issuer there. What would cause you to put money in the bank account? Well, you have more money. You want to save for a house. There's a lot of things that you could say, all right, I'm loaning this out to the bank for safekeeping. They can loan it out as well as long as they give it to me as soon as I ask for it. That's called a callable loan. You can call that back from them anytime you want. On a larger scale, if Ford or GM or any other major company out there says, we're going to issue bonds, we need a loan, and we'll pay X percent. That may be more, and it's hopefully more than the bank would pay. That more money that they are going to pay you is because there's more risk. What happens if General Motors or Ford or any other the company that you have a bond for isn't around to pay back the loan? That's a default risk. well, you want to buy bonds from companies that you think are going to be around for a while. Now, you can make a lot more interest at the beginning for bonds of companies that may not be around for a while. Why would you get paid more? The same reason why credit cards can charge people who may not pay back their credit cards a higher interest rate. Because you really want the money and you're willing to pay for the money, but people recognize the risk. So bonds are out there. Stocks are ownership. The ability to own part of a company. Why would a stock's value go up at the same time that a bond's value does? Well, if there's a really good company out there, a company that nobody thinks that they're going to default on their debts, and their earnings keep coming in well, then you would expect the value of their bonds to be higher and the value of their stocks to be higher. So in a perfect world where everybody's in good shape, and people don't care whether they're buying stocks or buying bonds for their investments, bonds and stocks go up at the same time or go down at the same time. If people say, hey, I need money for something all of a sudden, if a lot of people lose jobs around the same time period and they go through their savings and then they turn and they liquidate their stocks and their bonds. This is a kind of a representation of what happened in the Great Recession. Bonds and stocks went down at the same time there. They are not mutually exclusive. Most of the time, people say, I think I can get a better return in bonds or I can get a better return in stocks. So they don't buy bonds and stocks of the same company. That usually means that bonds and stocks act differently from each other at any given moment. Not all the moments, though. A lot of moments, if a company's healthy, it's doing well, it's got good reserves, there's a lot of companies out there that have money overseas that can't pay their employees big bonuses without bringing that money back here and paying an extra tax on it, that they've already paid taxes on the money, they would have to pay another tax on the money to bring it back. So they get a loan using that money as collateral to pay bonuses to their employees. That loan is the bond. All the tech companies are doing that. Apple is very famous for issuing a 100-year bond. Well, is that bond in good shape? Well, it is right now. We don't know what Apple's going to be in 100 years. Will it be around? I don't know. But yeah, you know, the idea that if their earnings are going up or other companies' earnings are going up, that their bonds should be worth more makes sense. There's another factor in here, and that's when interest rates move around. When the market says, I need more for my money because there's less of it being offered for loans. If you're trying to buy a house and there's only one mortgage company that will even talk to you, you don't have a lot of negotiating ability to get that interest rate down. If there's a lot of people that want to give you the loan, then the interest rate will come down because they're competing with each other. You can call one mortgage company and they say, I'm going to offer you a 5% rate. And you call the other mortgage company and you say that, hey, they're offering me a 5. Well, then this mortgage company may say, all right, we're going to give you a 4.5. And then the other company says, all right, we'll drop it down to 4. And that's the best, you know, we're talking about half point drops. It's not very usual. But to make the point, negotiation in the marketplace keeps prices reasonable. If there's a lot of supply for loans, a lot of mortgage companies out there trying to give mortgages, interest rates stay down. When interest rates drop, it means the value of a loan that you've already issued at a higher interest rate, people want that more. If you have a loan, it's your asset now. You loan somebody something and they're paying you an interest payment. And interest rates right now are much lower than that. But the person that's paying you the interest rate has pretty good credit. Now, there's nothing preventing that person from refinancing that loan somewhere else at a lower interest rate. But while they're not, you're still getting paid a higher interest rate. It's pretty nice. You can't go out to the market anywhere and get that kind of interest rate. And the market can't either. So they're willing to pay you more for that bond than you loaned. If you loaned $1,000, but the interest rate that you're receiving is higher than what the market is receiving, they'll pay you more than $1,000 to get that loan because they're looking at the value of the income. And when interest rates hover up and down like they have been doing, They're up a little bit, down a little bit. When interest rates go up, the value of existing bonds will go down. We've been saying that for years and years now because interest rates have been hovering down at this low level. Well, we've seen a creep up over the last 12 months, and we've seen the bond prices drop during that time period as well. Every time, though, there's a big threat to the system. Hurricane, funny thing enough, a government default. People buy more bonds, which is hilarious to me because you're buying bonds at a time when the government that pays the bonds may be saying, hey, we're not going to pay for a while. A government shutdown. When bonds are going up and stocks are going up at the same time, they go up for different reasons from each other. To say that every time that they go up at the same time, there's some kind of a bad thing about to happen means that that's the only data that you're looking at. What's caused bonds to go up lately? And they just took a little hit because the interest rate just came up over the past week. The reason why bond prices would go up would be because there's more people trying to buy them. And I think there's a relationship between the drop in the Bitcoin and the rise in the value of bonds right now. People were buying Bitcoins in China, and now they're trying to buy other things. And I'm about out of time this hour, and I'll talk more about this next hour, because it's fascinating that people can look at a very limited amount of data and start screaming about problems. There are problems that exist, and we can get to those. But like I said, about out of time for this hour. If you'd like to call us for next hour, 254-773-1400. If you would like to talk to me or Jeff off the air, we have a voicemail waiting during the weekend. We've got a real live staff during the week at 954-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us. You can email me directly, jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. That's The Personal Wealth Coach. Or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and listen to podcasts and so on. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. KTEM. Serving Central Texas. KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.